time, and I mean something particular in that, and how it's dealt with in mechanics. So the first part is going to be just about that, which is very general and applies to all forms of gravity theories, string theories, etc. And then the second thing I'm going to do here in the first half is keep going through the same set of notes. And then do the four, so this is of the positive cosmological constant paper, the 02, 09, 079, and do just the chapter four in it. And this will clarify from last time some of the things. Some things from last time. Then we're going to have a break. And then, as I said to the people who came in late, then I'm going to ask everybody who is actually not a student taking the course to go, because I'm going to then do something which most of the other people know, which is give basic introduction to the math and the basic physics that I'm using, differential forms, electromagnetism, Yang-Mills theory, and so forth, to which I really was assuming, and I realized it would be stupid to give lectures such that the students didn't understand them, who were actually taking the course. Okay, so that's the structure of today. So the question of time. Now, there is a big difference between ordinary theories and gravitational theories. Ordinary theories, I talked before about background dependent theories. Ordinary background dependent theories. So this is like ordinary quantum mechanics of a particle or quantum field theory. Okay. These have a fixed background geometry. And as a result, and this could be a metric, and as a result, they have symmetries. And what a symmetry is a transformation from solutions of the theory to other physically distinct solutions of the theory that have the same properties, for example, the same energy. So, for example, time translation variance, the time goes to the time plus some constant T0, is a symmetry, which we call time translation invariant, or a symmetry in space, x goes to x plus a constant a. These are symmetries of the dynamics. And it means that there is classically a set of solutions of the theory, and the symmetries act to take you to other solutions. And the same thing is true quantum mechanically. Now, background independent theories generically have no symmetries. No symmetries connected to space-time, so connected to space and time. And that's because they have no background geometry which is fixed. I mean, the translation invariance of ordinary mechanics is a property of the metric of Euclidean space. the translation variance is time. Time translation variance is a property of the structure of the theory, which presumes that there's a clock. So we can write equations like x double dot m is, you know, minus gradient of some potential is a function of x. And this dot is d by dt in some clock time. And you can change when you start the clock, but the clock ticks at a certain rate, which is not arbitrary, which is assumed to be fixed. So just with you, so, but because in a background independent theory, there is no such fixed structure, there's no symmetries. Instead, there are gauge symmetries. Now, the gauge symmetry is a, and it's a very, very important not to confuse a gauge symmetry with a symmetry, even though the word symmetry is in them. A gauge symmetry is a transformation from a solution to the same solution written differently mathematically. Okay. And examples of gauge symmetries are for electromagnetism, I mentioned last time, and when we talk about after the break, I'll talk about it in detail again. You take the vector potential and you make a transformation where you add to it the derivative of a function. That's a gauge symmetry because the electric and magnetic fields don't change. And this is believed to be just a mathematically different way of writing the same. It's convenient to write the field equations for Maxwell in terms of a vector potential, but the real physical thing are the E and the B fields. And the vector, different vector potentials that differ by the gradient of the function give the same E and B fields. Another example of a gauge symmetry tied to space and time is the following. Supposing that there is no universal dependable clock. Supposing that there are some clocks, but you're in a situation where no clock is better than any other clock. Then, so you might, so here you have trajectories which are x of t, but the t is meaningful. You might imagine a different kind of theory where there's some particles moving in space that have positions x of some parameter, I'll call it s to make it clear it's not t, and as s increases, the system evolves, but it might be that s has no meaning apart from greater or lesser than, which would be the case if there's no clock that is a fixed clock that the equation of motion depends on. In that case, you would expect, well, a different thing, you would expect to be able to describe the trajectories by x of s, or describe the trajectories by x, so these have some coordinates, by s, x of s prime, where s prime is any function of s, and you might just want to fix a property that's monotonic. That means that del f, sorry, ordinary derivative, df, ds is always greater than zero. So, and you might want this to be a gauge symmetry. Gauge symmetry means that the only thing that matters is how you, is the succession of configurations, but not the label, the time label. Okay. So this is an example of a gauge symmetry, say a time coordinate, s goes to s prime, which is a function of s. Now, I want to tell a little story. So it is clear conceptually. Now, it is also true that general relativity has a larger symmetry. So in general relativity, there's a symmetry that if you write coordinates on space and time, so these might be xi space, so by xa, I mean xi space coordinates, so that's a space label, and x0 is a time coordinate, and so a is an index that runs over the space coordinates and the time coordinates, and I might have a symmetry under x goes to some x prime of a, which is an arbitrary function of the axis. So I can use, this is what Einstein called general coordinate invariance, I can use any coordinates that I like. And the dynamics shouldn't depend on that. And a simpler, so this is called general coordinate invariance. A simple example of that might just be looking for a dynamical system where the time coordinate is arbitrary. And there is what we call here time reparameterization invariance. Okay. So is the concept clear? Now, Newtonian mechanics is not invariant under time reparameterization invariance. So if I look at, so if we look at Newtonian mechanics, given by, I'll write again, x double dot of t is minus the gradient of a potential. So that's the general form of Newtonian mechanics. That is invariant under this, let me call this G class, okay, under a symmetry, and let's be explicit, under t goes to t plus tau, x dot, which is dx dt, goes to dx dt. So, I mean, I'm spelling everything out. So, the rate of change of which something is changing in time, if you just shift the origin of time, doesn't depend on where the origin of time is. But, so, Newtonian mechanics has a symmetry under time. But consider what happens if you take, let's say, t goes to some t prime, which is some f of t, then x dot is dx dt, which is dt prime dt dx dt prime. So that goes to f dot dt prime dt is, no, I'm sorry, that goes to f times dx dt prime, and if we do it again, I take the time derivative again, that goes to f squared times x, let me be more explicit, dx squared dt squared goes to f squared d squared x dt prime squared plus a term which goes like df dt dx dt prime. Okay? So, and on the other hand, the. I could easily get something screwed up.
Prime here?
It
should be double.
Derivative
of x squared.
Right?
So you have t prime equals f of t up there.
No, I think, oh, this is a derivative here. You're right.
And also, yeah, there's a derivative here as well.
You're right. Thank you. However, let me complete the argument. Okay. The force doesn't change when you change the time coordinate, because the force is the derivative of a function on space, which is the potential. So under this, the gradient of a potential just goes to the gradient of a potential. And so this equation is not preserved. So Newton's laws are not invariant under time reparametrization. Now, Newton made a big deal about this philosophically and made speeches, for example, the Prolegomena to the Principia Mathematica, about how there is absolute time, which, to explain why there was a preferred time in the equations, he made reference to God and talked about absolute time being time as perceived by God and so forth. And at the time, there were philosophers, this was against the general point of view. The general point of view at the time of Descartes and Huygens and especially Leibniz was that space and time should just be aspects of relations amongst things. And if you translate what they said, they wrote long philosophical arguments. They also, these were great mathematicians and physicists also, but there were long philosophical and theological disputes about these things. But basically, what Leibniz, I'm sure I'm going to misspell it, and friends were saying is that mechanics should be invariant under time reparametrization. Because how could it possibly matter whether there was some universal clock which was ticking?
Yeah, Leibniz is spelled correctly there, definitely. Okay. Yeah, it does not make a T, which most people think it does. It does not make a T. No time in Leibniz.
Right, thank you. Thank you. Now there's an interesting story here. And the interesting story is that what Leibniz should have done to counter Newton is invent a form of dynamics which is invariant under time reparametrization. S goes to an arbitrary function of S, is S prime. And had Leibniz been able to invent an alternative to Newtonian dynamics which had that property, then there would have been a fair argument. As it was, Newton had the Principia Mathematica and everything that followed from that, and Leibniz had a bunch of principles and words and stuff. And it's interesting to ask, could Leibniz have invented an alternative and have countered Newton directly? And now we know that Leibniz could have, but it was not appreciated until recently. So there is an alternative form of dynamics just of particles. So this is what I want to show you, that there's a particle, ordinary particle, non-relativistic, so we don't have to get mixed up with relativity, time reparametrization dynamics. And what's interesting about this is that it's a very useful example for all the issues that come up in quantizing gravity. Because it deals with, in gravity, you have the whole issue of the general coordinate invariance, or in fancy language that's closely related to diffeomorphism invariance. And you have to wait to Dirac or big long books by Mark Knoll and people to get at that. But in this simple example, you can see the essential issues which come up in all approaches to quantum gravity. You can see the key hard issues. And I'm showing this to you not so much to discuss those hard issues, but because there are things you need to know when we go on to formulating general relativity as a gauge theory. Okay, so, and the form that I'm going to discuss was invented by Julian Barber and Bertotti in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s, in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. It turns out that these models had been invented by Schrodinger, I think in the 1930s or 1940s, but forgotten. And they had been also invented by Jacobi in the 19th century who didn't understand the significance and forgot them, yes?
Can you clarify the spelling of the names?
Sure, sorry. What I was doing here. B-A-R-B-O-U-R and B-E-R-T-O-T-T-I, I think. Is that right? Bertotti? Two T's?
Double T.
Double T and single T R. B-E-double T-O. Is that better? I think so. Oh, no, double T. I'll look it up. Okay, grazie. Okay, Bruno Bertotti and Julian Barber. Okay. And a long time ago, people thought that it was cute to call them BB models, but that was another error. I'm sure nobody will get that joke, which is just as well. But anyway, don't try before your time. So I want to present these. And in fact, these models played an important role in the world of quantum gravity and understanding these issues. So I'm going to go to the Lagrangian picture. I hope I can assume you guys have seen Lagrangian dynamics. Okay, so let me just remind you the same issue. So for Newtonian dynamics, I'll be a bit more explicit. I'm going to discuss n particles in d dimensions. So there are trajectories x, a, I of t, and this labels the coordinate, and this labels the particle, and the action is usually written as the integral dt from some t initial, ti to t final, and it's usually written as the difference between the kinetic and the potential energies, where the potential energies are only a function of the x's. In fact, let me leave that there for the moment. And the kinetic energy is the sum of the particles of m over 2 x dot ai squared. And under a time reparameterization, x goes to f of s equals s prime, the kinetic energy goes to f prime squared, that's basically what we had before, times the kinetic energy, and the potential energy goes to the potential energy. So the theory is not invariant. That is, the action does not go to the action when you change the time coordinate by an arbitrary function. So this is just, I said it here with the equations of motion, and I'm just saying it here with respect to the Lagrangian. Okay, now, Julian asked himself, and actually there was a prior set of models which were just by Julian Barber, and he asked himself, could I write a dynamical system which is invariant under this law? Well, and he succeeded. And so this is the BB models. And it's simplest, this would be more complicated to do at the level of the equations of motion. It's most transparent at the level of the the Lagrangian, the action principle. So consider this integral from t initial to t final dt. And now notice, and oh, by the way, I forgot to say the most important thing. dt goes to dt prime, t prime, which is f prime inverse dt prime. Okay. So under the transformation, t goes to f prime squared times t, but the integral dt goes to dt prime times 1 over the derivative of that. Okay. So even the kinetic energy doesn't match, because you have two derivatives of s divided by a derivative of f. So Barber said, why not consider, first of all, the square root of the kinetic energy? Okay. And just notice that that by itself is invariant, because dt goes to 1 over f dt prime, 1 over f prime, and the kinetic energy square root goes to f prime times the square root of the kinetic energy. So he started there. And then the problem is what to do about the potential energy. And the thing is that you can't add it, because then you have two terms which transform differently. So you only have one choice. Does anybody know what to do? Who does know, who hasn't seen this before? Okay, you multiply. And assuming the kinetic energy is an attractive system, so it's negative, they took minus the potential energy for a bound system, for an attractive system. And this is invariant. This goes to S under, I guess I have T here, under time requirementization invariant. Under T goes to arbitrary T prime, which is a function of T. So it is invariant.
What are the equations?
We're going to get to them in a minute. Okay. Now, notice that this is as ugly as possible. We're multiplying the kinetic, in a typical case, the potential energy is something like a sum over pairs of particles, I not equal to j, of some potential energy function of the distance between I, xi minus xj. That's typical for many forces like gravity and electricity and so forth. Okay. So the total potential energy is a very complicated function of the distances between all the pairs of particles, and we're just multiplying the kinetic energy by that. And then we're taking the square root of the whole thing. This is then becomes very non-local. The kinetic energy is a sum over terms for all the different particles. Usually the way we write it down there for the action is a sum. There's a free part, which is a sum over the action for all the particles. This just destroys that. We have a square root of a sum over all the particles. So it's very ugly. But it has this property. Okay? So I'm going to write down the equations of motion, but I'm going to do even worse than that. I'm going to quantize this right in front of your eyes. Okay? Because you know how to quantize this. You should. I mean, in simple examples, you've all done this if you've had elementary quantum mechanics. But how do we quantize this? Okay? And the first thing is to just understand classically what the hell is going on. Okay. Any questions? Yes?
Maybe this is being killed. But assuming that the equation of motion is different, you told it. So, I mean, the initial idea was that Kant could like this as an argument.
This is premature.
That's okay.
Okay. And I'm going to assume the case that this is an attractive force. Okay, so I can keep the minus sign. Yeah. Okay. So can we write down the equations of motion? And then you'll see why your comment is premature. So the equations of motion say d by dt, delta of the action, delta x dot ai is equal to delta s delta x ai, right? That's what the equations of motion say. So let me do each side. Well, I want the whole thing, so. I want everything on this board, and I realize I screwed up because I can't move that board, but okay. So the action again is the integral of dt, square root of kinetic energy, square root of minus potential energy. And let's first write down delta s, delta x dot ai. Okay. So we're taking the derivative inside the square root of the kinetic energy. So we get a square root of minus v over t times an m x dot ai. Okay, did I do that right? And now I want to take a d by dt of that. So I take a d by dt of all of that. On the other side, that should be equal to the derivative with respect to x, in which I take a derivative inside the square root of potential energy. So I'm going to get a minus gradient, let me write it out, derivative by the eighth coordinate of the ith particle of v times the square root of t over minus v. Okay, and those are the equations of motion. Now, oh my God, is there a half missing?
Yeah, on the right.
On the right.
You sure? Wait a minute, no there isn't. Mm. No, there's no half missing, because I had a half in here, and I got two. Oh, there's a half here, and there's a half here. Yeah, from taking the derivative of the square root, there's a half on each side.
No, but you can do that, because you have square root of the kinetic energy. So on the left-hand side, it cancels, but not on the right.
You have
one half mx squared. I have one half mx dot squared.
Yes, they cancel, but not for the.
No, they don't cancel. The two, there's two here. I love this. This much. Okay, the derivative of t dot is m.
Okay.
Now. And that looks horrible, and because look, the potential, the force felt by a particle is proportional to the ratio of the total kinetic over the total minus potential energy. And there's an extra term in here, which is the d by dt of the ratio of the total kinetic and the total potential energy. So this looks incredibly non-local and complicated and horrible, and what are you ever going to do with this? Okay. Does anybody know? Even like our sophisticated quantum gravity people here don't know what to do. Look, this is actually very simple. And the reason why it's very simple is that there is a gauge invariance. So if I rewrite this, let me rewrite this. This says the square root of, I'm just going to multiply on both sides by that equation. It says square root of minus v d by dt, the m can come outside, times square root of minus v over t d by dt of xi is equal to minus the gradient of the potential. Okay? And, but I have a freedom to change the time coordinate. Remember that. I have a freedom to change the time coordinate. So what I really want is a new time coordinate, t prime, which is a function of t, such that d by d t prime is equal to square root of minus v over t times d by dt. Right? That's what I would really like. Okay. Or f prime, which is dt dt prime, f dot, sorry. No, f, let me call it f prime, which is dt by dt prime, is equal to square root of minus v over t. Okay? So let me make that coordinate transformation. So let me go to t prime defined by this. Okay? And then this just becomes m d squared x dt prime squared is minus the gradient of the potential. Okay? So this is just Newtonian mechanics. Now, almost. It's almost Newtonian mechanics. There is one. T prime is f of t, therefore dt prime, dt, you're probably right, is f prime, which is df dt. Did I get it backwards? Yes. F prime inverse. Sorry. Thank you.
So we assume from a start that the system is indirect.
Yes. Oh, yes. If v were zero, you could not do this. Yeah, very good. Yeah. Yeah. No, actually, that's not true. I lied. If v were constant, you could do this. And if v is constant, then it's still not interacting.
But suppose it's zero.
If it's zero, there's a problem. Okay, but if it's not zero, as long as it's not zero, it's not a problem.
It's still interaction from v up there, that's the point. Everything's fine.
Yeah, then you could just have reparameterized anyway. But let me notice something. It's not completely free, because when you're done, what you've done is gauge fixed, if you like. But there's a condition. And the condition is that we got rid of this factor, which is now equal to 1. So the condition is that minus v over t is equal to 1, which says that v is equal to minus t, which implies that t plus v is equal to 0. So there's actually, in this gauge, where it looks like Newtonian mechanics, v plus t is equal to 0. And v plus t is the total energy. So the statement is that you don't get Newtonian mechanics. You get only those solutions of Newtonian mechanics which have zero total energy. So there is a consequence of the time reparameterization invariance. So E equals 0, if you like, is the consequence of the time reparameterization invariance. They're just, so quote, effect, pure gauge.
I see. Wrong word.
Yes.
But if you have a closed system and if you don't consider gravity, then you can just choose any which you want. So that you can always use that gauge.
Yes, yes. So what you're saying is right. So let me say it a slightly different way. You can always take a constant out of here. You can always have plus an E0 everywhere. And then you would end up with T plus V equals E0. So the statement is, and this was actually called in the 19th century Jacobi's variation principle, if you want the solutions of a system of Newtonian particles with only a single fixed energy, then this is a variational principle that gives you all the solutions with just a fixed energy. Now, since I can scale a constant out, I'm going to consider here the case that if there's any constant, it's just in V, and then write it this way as a total energy. But that's the actual statement, and that was called the Jacobi variational principle. So this was known in the 19th century, although nobody cared, nobody understood its significance. Okay. Now, so any questions? Any questions from the undergraduates? Any guys? Okay, is this clear? Okay. Now, let's quantize this system. To quantize it, we have to turn it into a Hamiltonian system. And if we have commutation relations and a Hamiltonian, we can write down the quantum mechanics. So let's try to write down the quantum mechanics. And the first step is to write down the Hamiltonian form. So we want to go to a phase space where there's positions, and I'll call them pi ai momenta. Okay. So we're going to, have you guys done a little Hamiltonian dynamics? Okay. So Hamiltonian dynamics starts by defining the momenta. The momenta pi ai are defined by, they're the derivative of the action with respect to the time derivative, are what is always universally the momentum in the Hamiltonian formulation. And if one works this out, then it's the same calculation that gave me x dot here. So this is equal to m x dot ai times the square root of minus v over t. So these are the momenta. Now, Dirac, who actually was the first person to work out quantizing from Hamiltonian formulations, really honestly, noticed something unusual could happen. And one could give a whole course on Dirac's understanding of Hamiltonian dynamics when there's a gauge invariance like this. But I'm not going to give the general arguments or the general proofs. Just watch what happens. Okay? What happens is that there's actually not all these momenta are free. there's actually a constraint amongst all these momenta. And so there's a general formulation of Dirac, which perhaps at a later stage I'll introduce, but it's a long formal thing where you go through the classification of the different kinds of constraints that can happen in a mechanical system and so forth. So I'm just going to show you what happens. There's a constraint, because notice what happens if I take pi squared for all the pi's and I sum them up. And so what do I get? And I'm going to divide by m. So that's going to give me pi squared is m squared over m, which is m, x dot squared, summed up. I'm going to divide by 2. And since I squared, I get minus b over t. Sorry, squared. Squared, square root, just minus b over t. But this is t. So this is equal to minus b. So actually, these momenta that we've defined are not all free. By definition, they're restricted by the statement that 1 over 2m sum of pi squared plus v is equal to 0. And of course, that again just says that the energy is equal to 0. But it comes out of the definition. And this thing has a name. It's called H for Hamiltonian constraint, as we'll see in a minute. So what does this mean? The basic idea of Hamiltonian mechanics is supposed to be that because dynamics is second derivatives in time, so I have here some space of solutions to the equations of motion. And naively, the solutions of equations of motion are labeled by initial data. I give the positions and I give the velocities initially, and that labels the solutions. So generally, this is the x's and the x dots. Now, the idea of a phase space is that there's a space of the x's and the pi's, rather than the positions and the velocities. And in a normal system, if you give the x dots, you give the momenta, and therefore every solution, instead of giving the position, the velocity, you give the position and the momenta, and this is also the space of solutions. But what's happened is the following. Because of the gauge invariance, there are fewer solutions. If I take a point here, and I take another point, which is x times a function times x dot, say down here, they correspond to the same solution, because I'm free to change the time coordinate. So because I'm free to change the time coordinate, I don't have... Now remember, there are a number of different particles, and they have a number of dimensions. So there's n particles times d dimensions initial velocity. Okay. But one of those is irrelevant, because I'm free to scale over all the units of time. So I'm free to scale over all the velocities. So not all of these are equivalent, are give different solutions. And so there's actually curves in the space of x's and x dots which correspond to physically the same solutions. So there's one less dimension here, and that means there has to be one less dimension here. So there has to be a constraint to lower the dimension of the solution space by one. Why? Because what happens to the x's and the x dots, okay, is pretty transparent, but what happens to the x's and the pi's when we scale the initial time coordinate? So there has to be some constraint that tells you that the initial data are in a space one dimension less, and that's this constraint. So there's a quadratic surface here of the surface h equals zero that the initial data have to live in. In other words, the real space of solutions, each solution is one of these equivalence classes under rescaling the initial velocity, and each one of them maps to a point on this surface. Okay? And this is called a constraint surface. Now, if what I told you is consistent, then we should worry about what happens when we evolve with the equations of motion. So we have to find, to evolve, we have to find the Hamiltonian. Okay, so let's find the Hamiltonian. Well, the Hamiltonian is pq dot, so it's the sum of pi ai x dot ai minus the Lagrangian, which is square root of minus, which is t, square root of t, square root of minus v. So we have to find that function. Now, x dot is related to pi times, let me go back here, x dot is equal to pi over m times square root of t over minus v. And therefore, it just scales through, and this becomes just the square root of t over minus v times pi squared over 2m plus v. So this is, so the Hamiltonian is this overall square root of t over minus v times the constraint. That's something you can, I did a little bit fast, but you can check it. Okay. And notice that this thing is quite arbitrary. This depends on what gauge you're in. This doesn't. So, and notice that this is zero. And we use a curly bracket to mean zero when you're at the point in the constraint surface, when you're at a point in the phase spaces on the constraint surface. So the Hamiltonian is proportional to this constraint. The constant, or the function of proportionality, tells you what gauge you're in. So in other words, this thing has information about which gauge you're in, that's which time coordinate you're using. But whatever time coordinate you're using, this is the Hamiltonian, and it's zero. Because once again, the energy is zero. Yeah?
Just a curious question. That all that stuff is not defined for particles which are addressed? Because then you have a problem with all the zeros, p is zero. If t is zero, you have like...
It's sure, if t is zero, you have a problem. Yes, if everybody is sitting still, you have a problem. I agree. There's some interesting degeneracies here. So another way to write this, this thing often is called n, and it's actually an arbitrary function of t. Because as we showed, by changing the gauge, by changing the time coordinate, you can make this anything you like. Because the t will transform and the v won't. So you can make this anything you like. So this is just some function of t. So I'm just defining some function of t, just square root of t over minus v. Now, what happens to h when you evolve? So now we should look at the Hamilton's equations. And I'm going to do that, and then I'll stop. Well, maybe I'll go a little bit further. Let's see how we're feeling. There's another blackboard in there. Oh, well, doesn't matter. So the Hamilton's equations are that any function of the coordinates and the momenta, the time derivative, is the Poisson bracket of the function with the Hamiltonian. Okay? So let's just check a few things. One of them is, and the Hamiltonian is just some arbitrary function of time times this constraint. So the first thing to check is what happens to the constraint. Well, that's the Poisson bracket of h with an arbitrary function times h, which is an arbitrary function times the Poisson bracket of h with h, which is zero. So if you start off, here I'll draw it here, here's the phase space, here's the constraint surface, and if you start off at a point in the constraint surface, you stay in the constraint surface. If you start off with H0, you stay with H0. So that's a consistent condition. And it just says that if the energy is initially zero, the energy is always zero. And by the way, let's just check, say, x dot ai is the Poisson bracket of x with the Hamiltonian. The arbitrary function just always goes through the Poisson bracket because nothing depends on it. And that's h times, if you work it out, minus the gradient of v. So you get back Newton's laws, but with this arbitrary function in it. And the arbitrary function is the square root of t over minus v, and that's what we had over there. So you get back the right equations of motion, but it's explicit that the parameterization that you use to evolve on your trajectory is arbitrary. So it's explicit in this formalism that the time coordinate is arbitrary. So, that's cool. Any questions? Now, how do you quantize this? And maybe I'll just start off doing the obvious thing, and then we're going to run into a problem, and then we're going to have a discussion. So I need a blackboard somewhere. Okay, I guess I can use this one. So, yes?
Just a naive question.
Sure.
There is a problem in the monasteries where the problem about children is.
We're going to address that right now. What happens? How do we deal with this climate candidate? So, there is an approach. So, there are two approaches to climate. Actually, there are now, there's more than two. There's a number of different approaches to quantum mechanics. I'm going to discuss the one which is the one that Dirac posed to deal with cases like this, which is called Dirac quantization. This is one that does not break the gauge symmetry. So you might now break the gauge symmetry and treat this like an ordinary system, but I'll discuss that later. I want to first discuss what Dirac proposed. And let me mention that the issues that we're about to run into arise in every quantum theory of gravity, because in general relativity, the time coordinate is meaningless. And because the time coordinate is meaningless, this issue arises. That is, there is a constraint just like this in the Hamiltonian form of general relativity. And it reflects the same issues. In fact, there's an infinite number of them because you have an infinite freedom to scale the time coordinate differently at different places in space and time. So there's actually an infinite number of these. But one is bad enough, as you'll see. Okay. So ordinary quantum mechanics would say, okay, I have some momenta and some positions. So I should quantize. I never said it. Whoops. I never said what the Poisson bracket was. And somebody should have told me that. The Poisson bracket of x with pi for the eighth particle, the ith particle, the a coordinate, the jth particle, the b coordinate, is delta ab delta ij. So that's the Poisson bracket.
So there is something wrong with that first x of x of the integral. It should be two dots on the Poisson bracket, x and h.
X dot the Poisson bracket is x with h, which is
the calcium force.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. It's minus n times pi. Over M. Thank you. Good. And while we're doing it, pi dot, and this is plus, and this is minus N, thank you, times the force. Okay. We'll cut that out of the recording. Okay. Now, so we want these to be represented by operators, x hat, pi hat, which are operators on some Hilbert space of functions such that as operators, x with pi have the same commutation relations times I h bar. B, J, B, A, I, J. That's what is a quantization. I'm sure there are fancy. I know that there are fancy definitions. I also know I don't understand most of them. So I hope it's worth. Okay. So there's an obvious choice. If we forget what's different about this, so the obvious choice is that the states are functions of the x's, the inner product is the integral dx psi absolute value squared. You know, x operator times psi of x, this is just the obvious choice, is x times psi of x, the pi operator times psi of x is minus ih bar derivative by x ai psi of x. Okay? So that's the obvious choice. And by this obvious choice, the Hamiltonian is just the operator form. I just translated into operators what the Hamiltonian is over here. So the Hamiltonian is an arbitrary function of time, which that's always there because we don't know what time coordinate we want to use. So we have to leave that free, that is an arbitrary function of time. Times an operator for this object H, where the operator for this object H is, not surprisingly, minus h bar squared over 2m del squared plus the potential energy. I've been being a little bit sloppy. There's a sum over the particles here. Okay? So that's ordinary dynamics. There's just one hitch. And the one hitch is that in the mechanical system, in the classical system, there's a constraint. So in the quantum system, according to Dirac, we have to impose the constraints. And the constraint is that this somehow, this classically, this expression H is zero. So quantum mechanically, it should be zero. Okay. Now, there's several ways you might do this. You might try to write this as an operator equation. As you might write that you're looking to solve some operators as a function of some other operators, so that it's zero as an operator. It's just the zero operator. But that's inconsistent with these definitions. The idea, if we tried to do that, we would have to find some other operators which realized the commutation relations, but which had the property that this particular combination of operators as operators were zero. Okay. And nobody knows how to do that, so we don't do that. Instead, what we do is we try, so this Hilbert space I call H, what we look is to find states on which the operator vanishes. And what that means is that we, so instead of doing that, we look for states psi such that the operator H on psi equals zero. And that we can do, at least at first. It looks like we can do that. Okay. There's a question, however, which is that everybody, so the basic philosophy, as Dirac now said, is that consider all such states. These states to live inside of what Dirac called the physical Hilbert space. Those are the states that on which the constraint vanishes, so that's the analog of the good classical solutions, and that should be a subspace of the Hilbert space, because we're looking at states that live inside this Hilbert space. Yes?
A historical question. Was it actually Dirac first composed this, or Gupta and Breuer for the Maxwell field? Was that before?
Or Peter Bergman.
Bergman.
Yeah, I don't know. It's disputed. Dirac, if there is a little book, if you want more of this than I'm going to say, and if you go into one of these fields, I strongly recommend it. There's a little book by Dirac called Lectures on Quantum Mechanics, which is 1964, Yeshiva Graduate School. And there's a funny little story associated with this, which is that Yeshiva University, which was a little religious university in Brooklyn, had a graduate school. And it had a small physics department and a small mathematics department. And the physics department at one time included Yakir Aharonov, Leonard Susskind, David Finkelstein, and a bunch of other people, Elliot Lieb, who's a famous person in statistical mechanics, and so forth. And they had offices in a little converted ballroom above a store. And Dirac came and lectured there and first presented these things there. Okay. And then the trustees of this university decided that they didn't need, there was a similar amazing mathematics department. They said, what does a little religious college need with a graduate school in physics and mathematics? And they fired everybody. So that's really a true story. It would have been the best physics department in New York, the best physics and math departments in New York, had they had they not fired everybody. So anyway,
Simian behavior.
Yeah. So and Dirac visited there from time to time, and whether it was Dirac or Peter Bergman, I knew Peter Bergman. There was a certain amount of bitterness about this, but in any case, I think it's usually attributed to Dirac. Also, Peter Higgs, the same Peter Higgs of the Higgs phenomena, figured some of this out, actually. But we call this Dirac quantization. Okay. Now, I'm going to just raise a couple of issues, and then I'm going to stop. One issue is that mathematically, this is a little naive, because let's look at a simple example. Okay, I mean, let's look at, you know, two particles, which basically means one particle, okay, with some r, which is x1 minus x2 as vectors. Okay, so we know how to solve this problem. Okay, this is looking for states such that minus h bar squared over 2m del squared plus v of r on the state equals 0. So this means basically energy equals 0 eigenstate. And we also want it to be normalizable. We want the integral of psi squared to be 1. And it's easy to find potentials for which there are no such things. In fact, generically, there are no such things. So there is a mathematical issue about the solutions are not so easy. That is, it has to be that the potential is such that there's an exact zero energy normalizable eigenstate. And you know, they're liking matrix modeling. There's a whole field of research about whether there are any or not. And so it's what Dirac wrote down very naively is can be a problem for ordinary systems. Okay. And there are some interesting questions there. And there are there's a number of ways of dealing with that, but I'm not going to discuss that now. But one way of dealing with it might be that you have to lift this condition and change the inner product. And this is something which is an issue in
quantum theories of gravity. Okay, I'm just going to keep talking anyway. But maybe Jacob will hear that it's dying. Maybe that's a signal I've done on me too far. The last thing, so I'll just stop here, is that if I try to write the Schrodinger equation, IH bar d psi dt is a Hamiltonian operator on psi, but that's equal to zero. So there's no time development. There's no evolution. Is that bad? Well, if there was evolution, then there would be a T here. This is the 90th hand waving story. Such that you would have evolution in that time. But that's really not true, because really there's this N sitting here. So you can get evolution at any gauge you like. But at this point, where many people say, oh, well, that's okay that there's no evolution, because if there was evolution, it would be evolution in some clock time. And the whole point of this is there is no clock. There's no clock outside the universe, so there is no time, so there's no evolution. So we say, great, it's philosophically beautiful, but then, where is time? And how do we understand time? And that leads to piles of discussions, and there's several chapters here in Carlo Rovelli's book where he just tells you that you shouldn't worry about that, because, well, now there are many points of view, and among the points of view are that, well, but the wave function, really, some solution of this is going to be a function of the different particles, x1, x2, you know, xn. So you could just choose the coordinate of one of the particles to be the clock. And then it gives you correlations between readings of the clock and the other degrees of freedom. So it's realizing a philosophy that the clock is inside the system. And the clock is actually the coordinate of some particle inside the system. So you will get freedom to choose which clock you have. Okay. Now just to summarize before we take a break, and I only did one of the things I was going to do. Just to summarize, so this is a complete example. And what it shows is how the issue of a reparametrization variance or a general coordinate variance, how it appears in the dynamics expressed in the Hamiltonian theory, and then how it affects the issue of quantization. And the basic feature is that the invariance under changing the time coordinate appears as the Hamiltonian being proportional to a constraint. So the energy is zero. The total energy is always zero. And that manifests itself in a quantization with a constraint. So instead of having a Schrodinger equation, you have a constraint equation. And that's generally true. Of course, in general relativity, it's more complicated because there's a freedom not just to rescale one time coordinate, but to rescale time coordinates all over space. There's also freedom to choose the coordinates on the spatial manifold as you like. So there are an infinite number of such traditions, classically and quantum mechanically. And you have to worry about their consistency. But this is the basic story. Thank you.
And I'm not going to go through the whole treatment of Dirac, but the basic result of Dirac is that there is one constraint for every gauge invariance. And I'll be giving examples of that. Okay, questions?
So what is the correct definition of the inner product? Is it null? I mean, suppose I have non-interacting particles, right? Can I quantize the system in this way? Null? I mean, up to the very end?
Yeah. I don't know for that case. I really don't know. And this, some of this is my ignorance. People have studied that, but it's an open issue. And in here's what one would have to do to discuss the issue more. If you can't work within the inner product that defines the operator, so what you do is you work in a kind of dual space to the Hilbert space. And when the Hilbert space are infinite dimensional, dual spaces can be non-equivalent to the Hilbert spaces. So you can find a dual space where you can work in, which starts off being even larger, and then you impose the constraint there, and there you find an inner product. And I can give examples of this later. When you do that, the inner product is, you might say, how do I choose the inner product? And the idea is that you should find some observables of the physical states. An observable of the physical state is an operator that commutes with this operator, because it will take physical states to physical states. And since you know who is real in the classical theory, you know who should be Hermitian among the physical observables. So the condition is to write down a sufficient number of operators which act on the physical states, which have to be Hermitian, and then you can solve it for the inner product.
But Hermitian implies already. Yeah.
No, but you can say, you can think about that, which you can say, I have a number of operators.
So you require that these operators are Hermitian.
Yes, in that inner product. And in some models like 2 plus 1 gravity or linearized gravity in different variables, you can go through this explicitly and you can see it happen explicitly.
But for this toy model, I
mean, for this toy model, you can have a
free particle, right? I mean, I should be able to find it.
You should be able to, and I'm just ignorant. I just haven't thought about it. But let me know that for an interactive system, it's far from easy to write down. So an observable is some operator take path such that it commutes with this operator, and that's a very complicated now operator equation. It's not even easy to find the classical solutions to that without a Poisson bracket. So, you know, let me say it this way, if you want observables on this constrained surface, again, you want observables, classical functions of x and pi, such that under Poisson bracket with h, they're zero, that means they stay on the surface. That also means they don't evolve with time, which means that they capture some information about correlations in them. And if they're interactions, such things are very complicated, nonlinear. Okay. So there is a prescription, and it has been, which I don't know actually, that certainly this part is not in Dirac. This is Dirac's nightmare, this part. And I don't know who it was who thought this through. It might have been, certainly I learned it from the lab, actually. And there's a prescription you can write down with a list of conditions on model systems when you can solve it you can work it through and see that you get a real inner product in the Hilbert space. But that's not a proof that you can do it in the full theory. And in real loop quantum gravity, this is there's another procedure to do it, which is to construct a path integral which gives you a projection operator onto the normalizable state so that the inner product is in the path integral. And just the slogan is that the choice of the inner product reflects the dynamics. And the way we usually do quantum physics is that we choose the inner product in the Hilbert space and then we solve the dynamics. Mm-hmm. What's happening here is the reverse. Because of the time reparameterization variance, solving for the inner product comes after you solve the dynamics. At least that's the general philosophy. And therefore, the inner product is expressed by a path integral, which defines the states of the theory, the physical states of the theory. And I'll discuss that part of the discussion, but much later on when we get to the path integral and the spin foams.
There's a book by Masai, a good introduction for the Dirac method, because you can get off the shelf in chapters.
No, because that's a conventional graduate textbook in quantum mechanics and does not go deep here. The good books are Dirac himself, which I don't think that's in our library, but I don't know.
It's a title one book which is described as constraint.
And now a title one.
I think about in the library.
Okay, so is that a now a title one?
There's also online from the archive. There's a review article by WIPF, W-I-P-F.
Okay, hold on. Is the book Canoe title one? Is that one?
I've seen.
So this book.
Dirac's book is also here.
Dirac's book is in our library. This book, Dirac's book, the part you have to read is 40 pages. Okay. This book takes those 40 pages and expands that into 500 pages. And you can choose yourself which version you like. I mean, there's many, many examples here and many details, but there's nothing in here that in principle is not in Dirac. Actually, that's not true.
But they link with Gage.
That's not true. Actually, there's a lot. And a different approach to this that I didn't mention is DRST approach, which they discussed in quite a lot of detail, which supersedes throughout quite a long time. And there is which? What's the name of it?
WIPF.
WIPF.
I think so. It's a nice review.
That's a person?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you did
it
first.
Yeah, I
know.
Okay.
Oh, we had some German. Anyway, so I do not, I mean, I'm happy over wine to get into a long discussion about the philosophical foundational issues here. What I've done, I don't intend to now, what I've done is enough that I can go back and talk about gauge theory and general relativity, but if people want much later in the course, we can talk about those foundational issues.
Actually, the quick introduction to this is in Wolfo, in the appendix.
There is, yes. Yes.
That's the 3 or 4 pages.
Yes, those are 3 or 4 pages which are equivalent to the 40 pages of Dirac. And definitely, I challenge anybody who's never seen it before to get it from the 3 or 4 pages in the talks. I'm going to be talking about Boyle later. Okay, so I propose we take a 10-minute break, and then everybody's welcome to come back, but when I'm going to come back and address the students, I'm going to talk about basically catch up differential forms, electromagnetism, Daniell's theory, and so forth. Okay, so people who know that sort of thing don't have to come back. See you next Wednesday.
Or Wednesday, not
Wednesday. Wednesday, yeah. And we'll be every Wednesday in this month, March.
This month?
In February. Yeah, in February. March 1st, Lisa Randall gives a public talk, and probably is rather dear her than me. So we'll see you Thursday. Even if you wouldn't rather hear that from me, I would rather.